This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757 and emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Signature support for our program comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services, led by Mr. Amin Walker and Jerry Lane Chevrolet. And we're endeavoring to make contact with Pearson Cross. I think we're having some challenges with the phones, at least with Dr. Cross, but he's written a compelling book about Louisiana politics. And as we know, in Louisiana, politics through the years has been a blood sport. And my friend Gus Weil and mentor used to say that we vacillate between populist and conservative, and we go back and forth. Well, it appears those days may be over, at least for a while. We haven't had a populist governor really since Edwin Washington Edwards. And even Edwards was tied to industry more than most people would think. But Pearson Cross has written a book, The Party is Over, The New Louisiana Politics. And he, with along with many people, including Robert Mann, and you go down the list, a lot of academics in Louisiana who follow politics, they have written essays in the book about the changing landscape of Louisiana. Dr. Albert Samuels has a very good essay in here as well, the gentleman we speak with at Southern University. But Dr. Cross is the man at UL Lafayette, and good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Doing well. Well, you make the case in your essay that the governor's office has changed a bit through the years. We used to have what was regarded as the most powerful governor in America, and you say that it's not likely the case now. The subtitle is The Shrinking Louisiana Governor. Why has the power shrunk?
Well, in part, it's because the legislature has grabbed back some independence, and we saw that recently with the overturning of that veto, that the legislature is asserting itself. It's not letting the governor pick who's going to be Speaker of the House and President of the Senate. And there's a real sense here that, you know, the governor is no longer just going to have sway. Now, the governor still has an enormous amount of power because of the capital outlay budget and all those things, but it's not like it used to be.
No. And yesterday, by the way, the legislature failed in an attempt to take away the governor's line item veto power, which is perhaps the most significant power a governor has. But the governor of Louisiana appoints people to boards and commissions. He has a big say in the budget. And if his party is in power, or her party, it makes it a lot easier, doesn't it?
It does. And one of the things that's going to be interesting to see is right now the Louisiana legislature, dominated, as we know, by Republicans in both House and Senate, are chipping away at John Bel Edwards' powers and, you know, seeing what they can strip. But frankly, this situation may change if they get a Republican governor more to their liking in there and they feel less partisan about it. So I'm wondering, you know, are they going to give the putative Republican governor of the future more power, or give a governor power back? Or are they going to regret having taken away some of the power from the governor? The legislature is not really designed to move quickly. So when you think about things like emergency powers and those kinds of things, it's probably bad policy to take that away from the executive.
You start your essay with a quote from Edwin Edwards in 1974, 48 short years ago. He wrote or said at the time, "The unusual power of Louisiana's governors is undoubtedly related to historical trends and cultural attitudes peculiar to Louisiana, but in the exercise of his formal constitutional powers and his role as a popular leader and chief administrator, the governor is in debt more to his own ability, to the evolution of American democracy, and to social and economic changes than to legal precedents." That was an interesting observation then and now, Pearson Cross.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the thing that makes studying governors both interesting and frustrating is so much depends on the personal characteristics of the person in the office, you know. So if you get someone like Edwin Edwards, who is supremely capable, who knows how to talk to the legislature, who knows how to pull the levers of power, both formal and informal, then you get a very powerful governor. If you get someone else who's much less adept at that or much less interested in doing those kinds of things, you have a governor that's quite a bit less powerful. So it's one of those areas where all governors are not created equal, despite the fact that they're all elected just the same.
Mm-hmm. And when the state has money, as it does now, the governor has a much easier road. And I heard someone say the other day that the new president of LSU, actually this was a board member, has done much better than King Alexander in getting goodies from the legislature. Well, the reason is because the legislature has money, at least for now. But as you know, Pearson Cross, those things can change in a year. And I would say those who are thumping their chests about the budget right now, in a few years, they may have a different story to tell.
That's absolutely the truth. And in fact, there was just a report out on by Gary Wagner, my colleague here at UL Lafayette, about the budget slowdown, or rather about the economic slowdown. Growth appears to be heading down. Job hirings aren't as much. Things look modest coming up. And so the money that is awash in Louisiana right now, which, by the way, makes everybody feel great. Everybody's happy when there's money to spend and on this and that. That's probably going to go away. And then we also know that the legislature hasn't dealt really in a wise fashion with this upcoming 0.45 budget cliff. So they you know, waived on the opportunity to do something about that to make the cliff a little less steep. And so one wonders what's going to happen in a more constricted economic time when all of a sudden $300, $400 million disappears from the general fund.
This book is a must read for political junkies. If you follow Louisiana politics, the party is over. Essays not only from Dr. Pearson Cross, but also from others, too numerous to mention, but Jeremy Alford's in here, Bob Mann, Joshua Stockley, Michael Henderson, Albert Samuels, John Moeller. He has a very good one on poverty in our state. But it is interesting, when I read through most of the essays, how many of them reference Bobby Jindal. And Jindal is remembered by many, including, I think, the people of our state, as a failed governor. But he made some changes in Louisiana that will be relevant for years to come, didn't he?
Yeah, he really did. I mean, in some senses, and it may take a while to realize this, Bobby Jindal was a transformative governor. And you could easily say for good or for bad. You know, clearly, if you are, as I am, a professor in the University of Louisiana system, you would say the things that Bobby Jindal brought to that system were awful. The system, along with the healthcare system, suffered the brunt of the budget cuts, and we've really changed the way we do business, and things have not been great over here. We look back fondly at Foster and at Blanco saying, those guys really liked us, but Bobby Jindal really had it in for us. But on the other hand, you know, if you look at areas like education and to a certain extent ethics, you know, he really did some things that I think are somewhat transformative in those areas, certainly led the way. You know, so I would say the ledger on Bobby Jindal is mixed, but I do think he's been more transformative, say, than John Bel Edwards or perhaps Blanco or Foster before him.
And the state, despite Jindal's justified criticism for not taking broadband money, for not taking Medicaid money, the state has moved with him as far as the elective representation at the Capitol. As you note in your book, in 2000, there were 70 Democrats in the House and 33 Republicans. Now there are 68 Republicans and 34 Democrats with Ted James leaving, but he has been replaced by Yvonne LaFleur. So it's 68-35. Then in the Senate, it was 26-13 Democrat to Republican in 2000, and 20 years later, 27-12. So we've had a complete shift, and this was largely in the era of Jindal.
Yeah, that's true. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we felt this book was very timely. You know, there had been a book by Wayne Parent. There had been Festival in the Labyrinth back in 1982 by James Bolner that was very much the same kind of book. And in fact, this book is in some sense a rewriting of that book. So you really have a snapshot of all the areas of Louisiana politics and policy by the people who are really most expert in those areas. And it's kind of an updating. And your example of the legislature illustrates the reason, the need for this kind of book, which is that, you know, 20 short years ago, this was a Democratic state dominated by a Democratic legislature. And then if we look today, It's a Republican state dominated by a Republican legislature. So huge changes.
Pearson Cross with us, and he looks at the last four governors and their major accomplishments, and some would say in some cases not accomplishments. But, for example, Bobby Jindal, ethics reform, which, of course, was shaky, but he gets credit. K-12 education reform, reorganization of the charity healthcare system. And he also, of course, undid the Stelly reform plan. Now, Mike Foster, his mentor, created the Louisiana Community College system. He expanded the TOPS program, and he got through with the power of the governor's office and his leadership, the Stelly reform plan that was promptly stopped by Bobby Jindal. Now, the legislature got it to his desk, and Jindal may not have wanted it to be there, but he had no choice, and he embraced no Stelly, and it caused lots of problems. We'll talk more with Pearson Cross. This is Jim Inkster, another segment with Dr. Pearson Cross, a professor of renown at the University of Louisiana Lafayette. His book is The Party is Over, The New Louisiana Politics, and it is in collaboration with many others who follow Louisiana politics. But Pearson's essay is about the shrinking Louisiana governor, and he compares the last four. And all four had significant accomplishments, including in just one term, Kathleen Blanco. The much maligned Kathleen Blanco had some accomplishments that you note that I think if you square them up with the others, she doesn't come out looking that badly, Pearson Cross.
She doesn't. And let me just note that this book was done with, edited as well by Dr. Christy Malloyd, my colleague here, and certainly it was a two-person endeavor. Rounding up all these authors and getting them to produce something, you know, is a very, very tough duty. So she was certainly right there with me and putting this book together.
Sure.
But as far as Kathleen Blanco goes, yeah, Kathleen Blanco, many people kind of, Katrina's sort of been the imprint on Kathleen Blanco's tenure here, although she was lionized in her later days as she was heading out with that terrible cancer that racked her body. But she was really about a B-plus governor. Most people were rating her pretty well prior to Katrina. She was in a strong position to run for re-election, probably would have been re-elected, in my view, fairly easily. And then Katrina happened. So looking back at what she actually did, I mean, teachers loved her. She raised the pay to the Southern regional average. She helped reorganize New Orleans schools. She rebuilt the Superdome. She kept the team in town. I mean, there were a number of things that she was really good at.
She also signed the trigger law that will outlaw abortion in Louisiana. And I know some of our listeners may not like that, but it is significant. And it was Kathleen Blanco, a Democrat, who did this. And, of course, even Edwin Edwards was on the record as being pro-life. Now, I think that was with a wink and a nod. But Blanco and John Bel Edwards, they are as conservative on this as Bobby Jindal was.
Yeah, that's one of the things, the commonalities about Louisiana politics is this is a pro-life state. Pro-life politics are very popular, and the only reason we've had abortion clinics to the extent we've had them is because of the national mandate through Roe v. Wade. So clearly, if that gets overturned, we have these trigger laws are going to take effect immediately, and I expect us to join Alabama, Florida, and some of the other states that are legislating on this issue. You know, and that's one of the things that I think is really different about Louisiana politics and how we've moved more in the mainstream now is that, and we see this, we are, you know, when it comes to transgender, critical race theory, abortion, charter schools, and all those things, we're becoming very much a Republican, conservative, southern state, and some of the things that made Louisiana unique are disappearing.
We have produced two elections in a row on the national cycle, with Donald Trump getting a margin of victory by 400,000 votes twice in Louisiana. The book is The Party is Over, The New Louisiana Politics. And Bob Mann writes a good essay about how the media are changing. And I can remember back in the day in the 80s in which a lot of public officials were indicted and a few after the 80s. But those stories often started with newspaper investigative stories and sometimes television, sometimes radio. But yeah, Bob notes that in 1983, then the state's largest newspaper, the New Orleans Times-Picayune, enjoyed an average daily circulation of 278,000 and Sunday circulation of 332,000 readers. The same year, the Advocate of Baton Rouge reported 77,000 daily circulation. In 2019, John Georges purchased the Times-Picayune, after purchasing the Advocate 6 years earlier, and now rebranded the Times-Picayune New Orleans Advocate, along with its Baton Rouge sister publication, the Advocate. The two papers report a daily circulation of 98,000. So there are fewer people reading. There are fewer newspapers available all over the state. And there are fewer reporters covering the Capitol. So what does that do? What does that do?
Well, it does a couple of things. One, it lowers the general knowledge base of the people, so people are less likely to get informed. As you point out, the stories that might be broke by reporters, and doing some investigative work are very much down. If you look at, for example, and Robert Mann's essay is just a jewel. I just love it to death. If you look at, for example, Gannett Papers, who at one time had Mike Haston and John Hill in the Capitol, they were both reported on the Capitol for Gannett Papers, full time. That's what they did. And now, if you look at Gannett Papers, not to specifically pick on them, but it's just an example, there's no Capitol reporter for Gannett Papers. They run Greg Hilburn up every time they need a story or they need some on-the-spot coverage. But it's not the same. And the people in Louisiana are being less well served by this. And as a result, I would say, as Bob Mann does, that we're becoming more partisan. We have less knowledge. Our arguments are becoming more heated.
And thanks to people like Greg Hilburn and Mark Ballard, who have stayed the course. But a story, Jeremy Alford did this story about 10 years ago, and it should be updated. Edwin Edwards, in his last term, his press secretary earned $25,000 a year. Now these jobs, all over state government, PR jobs, they make generally around $100,000 a year or more. And it's hard for journalistic entities to keep good people. Look at the reporters in the last decade who have gone to the other side, and some would say, who can blame them? The pay is more, the hours are better, the pressure is less. Pearson Cross, Mike Foster is the one who started this, and it has. It's a case in which in Louisiana, we may not be first in many things, but we're first in the rate we pay PR people in state government, and it is rated many of the best reporters in Louisiana politics.
Well, you're absolutely right, and who can blame them? Right now the newspaper industry and the media industry is generally cannibalizing its own, but if you are a communications major in broadcasting or other kinds of things and can land one of these very cushy, politically connected jobs or with government, you can really stand to do well and make some money, and you'll probably have better longevity. So it's just one of the changing industries that unfortunately has effects that are not that great for us as a whole.
Randy and Zachary. Hi, Randy. You're on. Please be brief.
Yes, it's been an enormous change. I was born in 1958. And Earl Long was governor. Boy, this bit had been a roller coaster ride.
Well, I don't think there'll be another Earl Long for a while, although John Kennedy, who's now Mr. Conservative, once had an oil painting of Earl Long in his office. Don't think it's there anymore, Pearson Cross.
The building I'm sitting in, the Mouton Hall on UL campus, of course, was constructed in the administration of Earl Long. So there's a plaque on the building, keep reminding me. Some of our other buildings here, were built during the Jindal era, mostly during the Foster and Blanco era. I know communications building here, Hawthorne Hall, was built during the Blanco era. So, but Earl Long, there'll never be another one like Earl Long.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, Dr. Cross, had the Supreme Court handed the presidency to Al Gore rather than W., could the favoritism for Mississippi's Governor Haley Barbour instead gone to Blanco, and therefore she would have got reelected?
That's an interesting observation.
Yeah, I don't know. That may be You may have too many contingencies locked in there, because Katrina's still going to happen, and that was a disaster that no one was prepared for, particularly the fallout after the levees failed, and it's unclear that any amount of federal aid was going to make that right at that moment. It certainly probably would have helped to have had a more friendly administration in the White House, but I don't think that alone would have done it, but it's an interesting thing you say.
And as Pearson Cross notes in his book, some of the accomplishments of Kathleen Blanco were after Katrina, the rebuilding of the Superdome, keeping the Saints in the city, that was essential, and also the charter schools in New Orleans. Now, some may not like that, but on the whole, most observers, most, not all, but most believe it's been an enhancement, and both of those happened under the watch of Democrat Kathleen Babineau Blanco. And another listener points out that those teacher pay raises were also helped by Katrina money, which is probably true, just like John Bel Edwards is benefiting now from COVID money. And we'll talk more. We'll finish up with Pearson Cross. Still time to get in, if you choose, right after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. Tanya Nyman on deck. Community advocate here in Baton Rouge. She's going to be talking about schools in our community, but I do want to slide in a few for Pearson Cross, the UL professor, and hopefully we'll have him back soon. This fine book, The Party is Over, The New Louisiana Politics, in conjunction with several other political writers, mostly academics, and his colleague, Christy Malloyd. Barry in Mid-City, please be brief. Barry, you're on with Pearson.
Good morning. I'm wondering if you've already talked about, I just tuned in, the impact of the internet and those people reading newspapers online, please.
All right. There are people, but they are counted as subscribers, by the way. So if it's an internet subscription. So, but anyway, that's where a lot of people go to get their news, and it's a 24-hour cycle, Pearson. You no longer have to wait overnight to find out what's going on. You can get information, and some of it actually might be true. But as we know, some of the stuff on the internet is just downright crazy.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And so the internet is great in the sense, of course, the 24-hour news cycle is terrible for reporters. Because they're constantly being pressured by their bosses to update their stories, to hit new things, new developments. So it turns into the 24-hour workday for them. If you go back to the day where, you know, the newspaper people would file their stories by a particular time in the afternoon, and then that was it, and they were done until the next day. So it's a much workable thing. There's also the point, you know, if everyone was going to the Advocate website or Gannett website or some of the other reputable Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and getting their news there and reading about issues, that would be great. But of course, they're not. They're going to these kind of partisan and far-fetched websites and getting crazy ideas that they then spread as truth, which is problematic.
Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, so as a taxpayer and somebody that works in private, you know, private business owner, I found Bobby Jindal to be very good governor. If you're a government worker, you probably didn't like him because he cut the cost of government, especially the pension program that was getting overbloated.
All right. What about Jindal's legacy? Will 20 years from now we look at him differently or not?
Well, I think he'll be recognized for his achievements, but I'm not so sure. I mean, Jindal brought in a huge amount of business cronyism. So for the small business owner, Jindal was terrible. For the bigger business owner or the business owner that had connections with government, I think he's pretty good. Can you take advantage of the industrial tax exemption program, for example? I mean, there's some pretty big giveaways, some pretty big sops to industry, privatizing the healthcare industry, for example. So from my standpoint, when you talk about big capitalism, Jindal was really good for those people who had. But for Main Street, for the small business owners, I'm not convinced that Jindal did much of anything.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace, please be brief. You'll be our final caller for Pearson Cross. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. So if the Supreme Court repeals the abortion rights and then the state ban kicks in, well, then you can watch the boycotts begin.
All right. Will that have a major impact in Louisiana, or will you just go on business as usual?
You know, I think there were 8,000 abortions last year in Louisiana. That's the figure, 8,600 or so, that comes to mind. You know, those people will go elsewhere mostly. It will not. We'll probably may lose some sporting events and some things like that. That's a relatively small number. We are not the abortion capital of the United States, but it is going to, create some major problems for people who have, of course, problematic pregnancies, ectopic pregnancies and other kinds of things, or need care in the second and third trimester for sure. So it's not going to be a huge impact, but it is going to push some people out of state.
Michael Henderson, in his essay, he notes a poll conducted in 2016 in Louisiana, Democrats and Republicans. Now, mind you, there are still more Democrats than there are Republicans in Louisiana. So this is interesting because among Republicans, those in favor of doing away with Roe v. Wade, 69% in favor, 27% wanting to keep Roe v. Wade. And among Democrats, 53% against taking away abortion rights and 39% in favor of doing what is about to be done. So there is a huge gap among people who are affiliated with parties on this issue and many others, as Michael Henderson notes. And as I stated, a must-read for Louisiana political junkies, and congratulations, Dr. Cross. The party is over.
The party is, in fact, over, and I would encourage anybody who's interested in Louisiana politics as it exists today to read this. I think it's balanced. There are a number of great experts in different areas, and I think it'll be educational and entertaining.
Thank you, sir. Good to visit with
you. Thank you.
And we're in studio now with Tanya Nyman, a community advocate. She is one of four East Baton Rouge Parish residents and taxpayers who filed suit last week seeking to enjoin the implementation of a new redistricting plan for East Baton Rouge Parish schools. Your thoughts, Tanya, about why you believe this is not a good thing.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show, Jim. Well, the lawsuits, actually, this one is filed in state court, and it's actually a very different argument than advocates have been raising in the redistricting issue. It's very tightly focused. It seems very logical to me. I'm not an attorney, but it primarily focuses on the fact that state statute requires that the political bodies adopt maps that do not split precincts, and the map that the school board adopted splits precincts. And they had another option on the table that didn't, and so it seems pretty straightforward.
But as we know, the courts sometimes rule in ways that are inexplicable. And what your thoughts about your chances?
Yeah, I don't know. This is my first time actually being a plaintiff on a lawsuit, so I'll be paying a little more attention to that. I think what's a little more interesting to me is the other issues that I've been really primarily focused on redistricting issues almost for a year now. Mm-hmm. I started the group Restore the EBR School Board, and what I was trying to do there was raise awareness about the harm that was caused in the 2014 reapportionment. Now, that ad is all separate from the lawsuit that's been filed.
We've got other issues, too.
Yeah,
but,
we do
But on this one, you believe the plan for East Baton Rouge Parish Schools is not good beyond the splitting of the districts. Why?
Right. Well, so the lawsuit is specifically just focused on those precincts. But in terms of the need to adopt a different kind of map for us, that is certainly related to the harm that was caused by the 2014 reapportionment. And I think what really a lot of people need to understand is the way in which Citizens United has impacted our I hate using impacted as a verb, excuse me. Okay. Citizens United has affected the way in which districts and the way in which maps and the way in which unlimited campaign contributions influence our democratic elections. And so what I see is since the 2010 decision in Citizens United and the influence in our governance structures is a tendency to enlarge those districts in a way that allows for unlimited campaign contributions to exercise undue influence. So trying to get people to understand the need to reduce the size of those districts, the constituent to elected official ratio, and so that grassroots candidates mm-hmm. can have a real opportunity.
The case has been assigned to Judge Tarvald Smith, and Tanya and the plaintiffs note that in the months leading up to the adoption of the plan, the district hired, then parted ways with a demographer, changed timelines for adoption, put aside an outpouring of public support that she says was there for alternative plans that would have complied with state and federal law. Why were those just shunned?
Well, so this is my perspective, right? I think the single-minded, trying to figure out the best way to approach this, because of course I don't want people to confuse this state suit with the other issues that we were raising. And what that that quote from the press release references is the amount of attention community advocates brought and support of the alternative plan, the Ware Collins 11 plan. And what we all recognized in that was the need to adopt a map that would allow for fair elections. I see it where I sit is I see that we're in the late stages of, there's been a long-term effort to privatize the public schools in East Baton Rouge Parish. Your previous guests even referenced the proliferation of charter schools and the way in which laws advocating for the support of charter schools has been implemented in the state, starting with Blanco getting a lot of credit for the New Orleans issue, right? I for one, do not see the benefits to a privatized model. And so I've spent a lot of time trying to underscore the need to protect the democratic control of our schools. And we cannot have the democratic control of our schools if we do not have a fair map. And so that was what a lot of advocates, myself included, spent time trying to raise awareness for. And certainly the support within the community was for the map the school board chose not to adopt. It was an 11-member plan. It was racially proportional. And it didn't split any, and the most relevant piece of information in this issue is that it didn't split any precincts.
Tanya Nyman with us for a few more moments, and we've had a few inquiries about Sito Narcisse. It seems every day the superintendent is in the news. Do you think he's doing a good job?
I've been openly critical of Mr. Narcisse, and if people want to read the arguments I have on it, I do have it's tanyanyman.substack.com, and they can find some more pieces that I've written there. Dr. Narcisse was appointed by a school board that has an 8-1 business-backed majority. I do think that he has a record of encouraging the proliferation of charter schools, and so I think a lot of his policies aren't geared towards actually providing for a sustaining a unified system with a traditional public school model that is subject to the democratic control of taxpayers. And so,
all right, we'll spend a few more minutes with Tanya Nyman. And by the way, if you look for her on the World Wide Web, it's TANIANYMAN. And then we'll hear from Alex Horowitz about payday loans, an issue that has resurfaced. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Alex Horowitz with the Pew Charitable Trust Consumer Finance Team. He's following legislation involving payday installment lending in our state, Senate Bill 381. But we're finishing up with Tanya Nyman, community activist and advocate, and she follows the plight of Baton Rouge schools. And more than a few listeners have asked about Superintendent Narcisse, and there was a story. Charles Lucier covers this issue very well, but this was 5 days ago. A group of prominent black leaders say they support in principle Superintendent Narcisse's recent forced reassignment of educators from their current schools to other schools. What are your thoughts about that?
As I mentioned, you know, I have to oversimplify that issue a little bit at the moment. Certainly the difficulty with attracting and retaining teachers with a lot of experience in the schools that have the most challenges, you know, the fewest resources and everything else, has been historically a problem. If you talk to Dr. Press Robinson, he'll talk about the fact that that was one of the motivating forces for their lawsuit in the 70s to create single-member districts, was because they were having difficulty getting teachers assigned and kept in the schools in the majority African-American communities. But the claim or the desire to create equity and the effect, the policy you adopt to achieve that equity, well, those are two different things, right? Your intentions do not necessarily drive equity. And so I think in our current landscape, the proposal that Dr. Narcisse put out there, unfortunately, would not achieve the equity that he claims. Now, I can be a little more critical and say that ultimately what it would do is further destabilize our programs and destabilize our traditional public school system and paving the way for a proliferation of charter schools and for magnet schools to, you know, parents at magnet schools to pull the parent trigger and just charter those, which, might,
right.
As an aside, would be the institution of a Jim Crow era style governance structure. But maybe he's just unfamiliar with our laws and the way in which the Louisiana charter school law is written. And I haven't sat down with Dr. Narcisse to know.
All right. We're short on time, but you follow this issue closer than anyone I know. And what sources do you use?
In the equity issue?
All of it.
Thankfully, I have a lot of people and the day-to-day proposals. I'm more of the big picture person. So, for example, I did research the when I was trying to do the redistricting issue, I looked back at a lot of the newspaper articles, even simply from The Advocate. When I was, in order to understand the 2014 reapportionment, I was vice president of One Community, One School District at the time. We looked at everything from data on the school performance scores and how they correlated mm-hmm. with poverty in those districts. Of course, that was Dr. Belinda Davis, who is currently serving on BSEE and who's a professor at LSU, was very good at getting a hold of that data from sources. But I generally do that. And I also look at the way in which education models are being instituted in other school districts around the country to see what has been a pattern.
All right. Thank you, Tanya Nyman. Let's talk again soon. And we are joined now by Alex Horowitz with the Pew Charitable Trust Consumer Finance Team. And he has been following legislation in this state and in others regarding payday loan operations. We know we have more payday loan centers in Louisiana than we do McDonald's. And Senate Bill 381 would allow a $1,500 high-cost loan with $1,500 in finance charges, a total repayment of $3,000 in seven monthly installments of $428.57. That's 253% interest. What are your thoughts about the legislation under discussion, Alex?
Well, this bill in Louisiana that is being discussed right now wouldn't solve the current problem, where Louisiana residents get charged four times more than residents of other states for payday loans. It would just allow bigger loans, where Louisiana residents could still be charged four times more than residents of other states for payday loans. So right now, borrowers in other states can borrow from payday lenders, and the same payday loan chains operate in Louisiana that operate elsewhere. The difference is that other states have rate limits in place and consumer safeguards, so loans are much more affordable. In Louisiana, that's not the case.
Why do you think we're reluctant to change?
Well, policymakers may have a goal of expanding access to credit or worrying about borrowers getting access to credit during tough times, but other policymakers had that concern too, and they found a way to solve it. It's a false choice mm-hmm. between having 400% interest rates or access to credit. You can have access to credit on affordable terms, but that's not what this current bill under consideration would achieve.
You note that payday loan borrowers end up paying an average of $520 in fees over 5 months for a loan of $375. So if I'm following you, that means they're paying $895 for $375. Is
that's
that right?
That's exactly right. Most people who use payday loans pay more in fees than they got in credit.
And yet people do this, and you would think that maybe the reason why these places are so plentiful in our state is that we have a high poverty rate, and some would say this is predatory. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, what we look at is whether loans have affordable payments, fair prices, and a reasonable time to repay. And we found that it's possible to have those with widespread access to credit. States like Ohio, states like Colorado, states like Virginia, Hawaii, they've all achieved that. And so they have widespread access to credit, like Louisiana does. The difference is that borrowers there pay much lower prices and they have much stronger consumer safeguards. So the difference between Louisiana and other states isn't access to credit. There's access to credit elsewhere too. It's that other states have consumer safeguards and lower prices.
We're with Alex Horowitz in our final stretch here. The number is 877-217-5757. If you'd like to get in under the wire, Senate Bill 381 would allow a new $1,500 high cost loan with $1,500 in finance charges, which means a total repayment of $3,007 monthly installments of $428.57. That's 253% annual interest. So it is a case in which people will pay a lot to get a little, and shows kind of the economic instability we have in our community. And a listener asked a good question. What happens when these people don't pay? What happens to them then?
So every payday loan borrower has two things in common. And about 12 million Americans use these loans annually. They all have an income and they all have a checking account, because the borrower's checking account on payday is their collateral for the loan. So payday loans are actually repaid at very high rates, because payday lenders require access to the borrower's checking account on payday. So they are first in line to get repaid as soon as the paycheck comes in, even if that means the borrower can't pay their other bills, because the payday lender was repaid first.
Which may explain why this is such a plentiful business opportunity for many.
Payday loan stores don't need many customers to be profitable, because the prices are so high and because they have access to the borrower's checking account on payday, so their repayment rates are strong, even though borrowers have low credit scores.
And some may rationalize that this is helping people get back on their feet, but my goodness, it doesn't appear that's the case.
That's right. We see that payday loan borrowers struggle once they begin taking loans, because most people can't give up a third of their next paycheck. And the average payday loan today takes up about a third of the borrower's next paycheck. So they end up taking out another loan and another, which is why we see borrowers in debt for an average of 5 months of the year after they took out a two-week loan.
But people listening to this, and I'm hesitant to say it, but it looks like a solid business opportunity, unfortunately, for people who want to take advantage of people in need.
Well, we see the market changing a little bit, because some banks are starting to offer lower cost loans, and that could really be a game changer here, because every payday loan borrower has a checking account somewhere. So if they could borrow from their bank, that could save them hundreds of dollars each. And 7 of the top 12 banks have recently launched or announced a new small dollar loan, which could create new affordable options and mean that people who have gone to payday lenders for a long time can now borrow from their bank at prices 10 to 15 times lower.
Evelyn and Zachary, please be brief. Evelyn, you're on with Alex Horowitz of the Pew Charitable Trust.
Thank you. I'll be very, very brief. 99.9% of individuals who file for bankruptcy protection, either 7 or 13, include at least 3 or 4 payday loans in their list of creditors. So the payday lenders are still making money, even though a vast majority of their customers file for bankruptcy protection. Thank you.
All right. Would you respond, Alex?
We do see that when people start using payday loans, that increases the likelihood of bankruptcy down the road. But for a lot of borrowers, they end up not getting there, because filing for bankruptcy costs something too.
Well, we're short on time, but a listener notes accurately that some states have passed reforms. I know Colorado did, and I'm looking at your information. You note also that Virginia, Ohio, and Hawaii did. What did they do?
That's right. They gave borrowers more time to repay in installments at much lower prices. So as an example, Virginia has a monthly maintenance fee, but it's capped at $25. Ohio has a monthly maintenance fee. It's capped at $30. Under this new bill, SB 381, there could be a monthly maintenance fee, but it would go up to $195, whereas other states are capped at $25 or $30.
Well, thank you. Alex Horowitz of the Pew Charitable Trust. It's good to visit with you, an important issue that affects many people. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet provide signature support for our program. Stay safe and stay tuned.